Hey folks, if you haven't tried Audible yet, what are you waiting on? You've heard me talk about it for a while now. Audible offers an incredible selection of audiobooks across every genre, from bestsellers to mysteries and thrillers, true crime and more. Audible is the home of storytelling. You'll discover thousands of podcasts from popular favorites to exclusive new series. As an Audible member, you can choose one title a month to keep from their entire catalog. But members also get full access to a growing selection of included audiobooks, Audible originals, and podcasts, and you can download or stream those included titles all you want. And the Audible app is great. Makes it very easy to listen anytime, anywhere, whether you're traveling, working out, walking the dog, or just doing your chores. Right now, I'm listening to a thriller titled Then She Was Gone by Lisa Jewell. It's absolutely amazing. New members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/TCAT or text TCAT to 500-500. That's audible.com/TCATT or text TCAT to 500-500. Hello, everyone, and welcome to episode 237 of the True Crime All the Time podcast. I'm Mike Ferguson, and with me, as always, is my partner in true crime, Mike Gibson. Gibby, how are you?
Hey, man, I'm doing good. How about you?
I'm doing well.
Good.
I'm doing well. I think you and I are both doing much better than we have the past couple weeks. I think most people know, but we'll throw it out there. I mean, you were in the hospital last week.
I was.
For about 4 days.
Yeah.
And
the week before that.
And you were in the hospital the week before that. But because of that, you missed CrimeCon.
I did.
And, you know, I hated that. There was a lot of people that really missed you because they were wanting to see. Everybody wants to see Gibby. And
I missed them too.
But my wife and I went. We had a good time.
Yeah.
We kind of used it as an extended 25th anniversary kind of trip.
Well, good. It was needed.
But we got to meet a lot of good people and some great fans and all of that. It was much different than previous years, I'll say that.
Sure.
Much smaller. They had to, you know, keep the numbers down
and
everything, but we still had a really good time.
Well, I think they're going big next year.
Well, Vegas, I think, is going to be huge.
Yeah.
I really think it is. And I'm looking forward to it.
Yeah, same here.
Gibbs, let's give our shout outs.
Let's do it.
We had Jerry Deanne Shields.
Hey, Jerry.
Randy.
What's going on, Randy?
Tiffany Hunt.
Well, appreciate that, Tiffany.
Karen Meinert.
Hey, Meinert.
Kristen Vietti.
Ooh, Vietti.
Lula Blue jumped out at our highest level.
What's going on, Lulu?
Jasmina Salisbury.
Ooh, Jasmina.
Jorny Buffington.
What's going on, Buffington?
Char Mills jumped out at our highest level.
Hey, Char.
Stacy Thomas.
Hey, appreciate that, Stacy.
Lori Hare.
Hey, Lori.
Leah Boss.
What's up, boss?
Jenny R.
Hey, Jenny.
Amanda C.
Well, appreciate that, Amanda.
Tilly Ashby.
Hey, Tilly.
Sarah Meeks.
What's going on, Meeks?
Alyssa Perdome.
Perdome.
Adrian Anderson.
Hey, Adrian.
Yo, Adrian.
Yeah.
Marin Mothershead.
What's going on, Mothershead?
Ashley Alvis.
Hey, Alvis.
Jen Haynes Noblet.
Noblet Noble.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And last but not least, Destiny Strike.
It does sometimes.
Which is a very cool name.
Yeah.
If that's somebody's real name, that is kick-ass.
It is.
I like it. Let's go back into the vault, Gibbs. This week, we selected Tessa Alderton.
Hey, Tessa.
So we appreciate the new support, the continued support on Patreon. We had some great PayPal donations as well from Sean Sudith.
What's going on, Sudith?
Gothic Babe.
Hey, Gothic Babe.
Kelly Gilstrap.
What's going on, Gilstrap?
Jack Teague.
Hey, Jack.
And Susan Beck.
Appreciate that, Susan.
So thanks to all of you as well. You know, speaking of Patreon, Gibbs, we had a merch winner for May, and that was Jennifer Vaughn.
Hey, congratulations, Jennifer.
Yep, exactly. I also wanted to mention to everybody, we have some new merch.
We do.
Out on our website. Post-it notes, chapstick, lanyards.
Yeah.
That you can put like your work badge on.
It's fancy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Some of those little silicone wristbands. They say true crime all the time. And on the other side, they say stay safe and keep your own time ticking.
So is it the new chapstick and also the used chapstick?
Yeah, we have new and used.
Yeah.
Now, if you want it used by Gibby, that's going to be a premium.
It is a premium.
You charge extra for that.
An extra quarter.
But we got some cool stuff out there.
We do.
You know, make sure you check it out. Gibbs, right now on Unsolved, we have an episode out on the mysterious disappearance and reappearance of Jim McDonald.
It's interesting.
This is an interesting episode because there's no murder.
No.
There really is no quote-unquote crime per se, you know, depending on how you want to look at it. You know, this is a case where, you know, you really kind of have to soak up all the facts, and there are some people who are going to think it went down one way.
Right.
And others that think it went down a different way.
Definitely scratch your head a little bit.
Yeah. I think it'll be different and like we said, interesting for the audience. All right, buddy. Are you ready to get into this episode of True Crime All the Time?
I am.
We are headed to the state of Delaware to talk about murderer Gilbert Cannon. And I'll say this, this is a little bit of a different type of episode for us as well. You know, we start off our story talking about a guy named Charles Holden. And this is a man who decided, Gibbs, to show some kindness to a stranger, give him a ride. He had no idea that he was giving a ride to a murderer because Gilbert Cannon was high on cocaine. He was looking for a place to stay that night. Things went bad during this kind of ride he was given. We'll talk about that. When it was over, he started walking the neighborhood looking for a place to crash.
Right.
And he ended up breaking into the home of a woman named Dorothy Donovan, who happened to be the mother of Charles Holden, and he brutally murdered her. Now, Gilbert disappeared, and basically, you know, Charles was left to say, hey, this man killed my mother, but police didn't believe him. So you kind of have like a fugitive type situation. It's not quite the one-armed man, but it's similar.
Sure, yeah. This figment of your imagination guy. Who is this guy? Nobody
right.
knows anything about this guy.
We didn't see him.
Right.
We don't know who he is. All we have is you telling us that all of this happened. And really, it took a pretty fortunate series of events to figure out who the real killer was and lift suspicion off Charles that he murdered his mother. It was on June 22nd, 1991, that 40-year-old Charles Holden left work after finishing his 4 to 11 shift at a local factory. So a second shift, right? It's a pretty normal second shift around here.
Yeah, it is.
Close to midnight, Charles stopped at Hardee's and he ordered a hamburger and a coffee. That might seem strange to most people at 11 o'clock to get coffee, but for those of you that have worked second shift and even especially third shift, it kind of plays with you a little bit. At least for me, it did when I, back in the day when I did that.
Got to get your coffee in, huh?
Well, it just, you know, it's such a different schedule. Now, if you're used to it and you do it all the time, I get it. I was on like this rotating schedule. So I would work, you know, a couple of weeks mornings,
right,
a couple of weeks second shift, and then a few weeks third shift. I couldn't get the hang of it. I was all over the place. Couldn't figure out when I was supposed to sleep. It messed me up.
I always liked working third shift when I did back in the day.
Yeah, I didn't mind third shift. I don't think I would have minded it if I had been on it longer.
Right, steady.
But to rotate like that, it really messed me up.
And I'm not a coffee drinker, so.
Well, you know I am.
Oh, you're night and day between me and you there.
So this Hardee's restaurant, it was just half a mile from his house on 384 Kent Street. Charles lived in his own trailer, but he lived next door to his mother, who lived in an old farmhouse. Together, they had 160 acres of land just outside of Harrington, Delaware.
Nice little spread.
That's quite a bit of land. Dorothy Donovan was often alone while Charles was at work. And again, I mentioned it, he worked nights. So Charles got his food, he got into his truck, as he was about to leave the Hardys, a man came up to his window and asked for a ride. The man told Charles that his sister was having a baby and he needed a ride to Georgetown Hospital. Now, at first, Charles said no, telling the man, "Hey, guy, it's late. I just got off of work and I'm just a few minutes away from my house." But something changed his mind, right? He deliberated on it and he later said that he decided that he wanted to be kind to this guy because he felt like he really needed help. So Charles changed his mind and he agreed to drive the man to the hospital. Now, Harrington's a small town. Everyone there is friendly. Everyone knows each other. And, you know, Charles has said he thought it was a harmless situation.
Just trying to give a guy a ride to the hospital.
Right.
Yeah.
Now, would you do that?
No.
And you know for a fact I wouldn't do that.
No.
And does that make us bad people? Maybe. In some small way, maybe. I don't like taking chances with my safety. I've talked about it a number of times. Now, if it was you and you called me on the phone and said, "Hey, my car is broken down."
Right.
"I'm on my way."
Yeah.
Or any of my friends or family or, you know, even extended coworkers or people that I know, fine. I'll do whatever you need me to do. A stranger knocking on my window? No.
See, I should have known that. See, I could have called you both those times I had to go to the ER instead of driving myself.
Yeah. I thought that was, I told you that when it happened.
Yeah.
You should not be driving yourself to the ER in the condition you're in. Now, I didn't know about it till after the fact.
Well, of course,
yeah. Or I would have been up there. But, you know, to me, the stranger at 11 p.m., midnight, kind of approaching you, that is a situation that I'm going to extricate myself from. It just plain and simple. And people can think whatever they want to about me because of that.
Right.
Some people will think, well, oh, you should help people. And I get that way of thinking. If you want to do that, pour it on.
Sure.
Me, I'm a much more defensive-minded type, safety-conscious person. I just am.
We've covered too many cases.
Yeah.
Where we know where this goes.
And you know I was before. But doing the podcast for, you know, almost 5 years, I think has made me even more so, more protective of my family, more protective of certain situations. Now, initially, Charles told the man that he would drive him to the hospital. But about 3 miles down the road, he stopped at the intersection where he normally turned to go home. And he told the man that that was the end of the ride. He couldn't take him any further. So he changed his mind about that as well. And it really kind of happened very quickly. This stranger got extremely angry, tried to attack Charles, demanded his money, demanded his truck. Charles managed to grab his keys and jump out of the truck. And he ran to a nearby store to ask for help. But this guy Gibbs was chasing him with the screwdriver.
Yeah.
Charles's own screwdriver that he got from the truck,
right,
threatening to kill him. So obviously this is a situation that went from 0 to 60 in 3 miles. Basically the minute that he said, "This is the end of the ride," all hell broke loose. Charles feared for his life. So he agreed to take the man to the hospital. He got back in the truck. But as the man walked around to get into the passenger seat, Charles sped off.
Good move.
It is a good move. Now, it's going to turn out to be strange as we move along in this story. But if you think about it in theory, it's a great move. Somebody's threatening you. You act like you're going to placate them, but with a plan, knowing that you're going to get in the car first, you're going to stomp on that gas and get away before they even get a chance to get back in the truck. And from what I understand, Gibbs, this man literally tried to keep up with him, like chase the truck down.
Like he's the bionic man, bionic
or bionic.
Yeah, man. Yeah. Steve Austin, I'm going to catch you
again. You know, it's so strange because you would think back when the Bionic Man was on, it was free television.
Sure.
So you would have gotten the same programs that I got. I still think you got some kind of generic version.
I probably did.
And you didn't even have to pay for it.
The Bionic Man.
The Bionic Man. He wasn't quite as good as the Bionic Man.
He wasn't the $10 million man or whatever. He was the $10,000 man.
Was it the $5 million man?
I don't know.
I don't remember.
Yeah.
But he was the $1,000 man.
He was a discounted version.
He could do a few things, but not real well.
He was the first try at it. And they're like, you know, it kind of worked, but not all the way through. So, yeah.
So there were witnesses that saw the man at the restaurant. One witness saw the fight that occurred at the intersection. And you have to think, Gibbs, Charles is shaken up. I think anybody in this situation is going to be shaken up. And what he decided to do was not drive towards his house, right? Drive away from his house because he didn't want this guy to follow him.
Sure.
Which is actually smart as well.
It is.
In any situation where you think someone is following you, well, don't go straight home.
No.
You know, drive through other neighborhoods, lose them, make it hard for them to kind of keep up with you. I'm sure that was part of it. I'm sure he was also shaken up and probably just needed some time to calm down, right? I'm going to take a little drive.
Plus, he's got to be a little pissed. His Hardee's hamburger was cold.
Yeah. Probably spilled his coffee during the fight.
Yeah.
Now he's got nothing. But at a certain point, he felt ready to go home. And as he approached his trailer, he saw something which had to be horrifying. He saw this same stranger kind of lurking around in his front yard, peering into his windows. And this guy ran off when he saw the headlights of Charles's truck. So that scared him again, right? Charles, he drove off, left his trailer, because he's like, this guy's here. You know, I got to get out. He went back to Hardee's to use the payphone to call the police. So he called 911 at 1:19 a.m. to report a prowler at his residence while he waited for police. Because he didn't go back to his house. He was waiting for police to meet him there so that he would feel safe.
Sure.
But while he was waiting, he called his mother. Because remember, she lives right next door.
Right.
He wanted to warn her that someone was on the property. She never answered any of his calls.
And that's probably where I differ a little bit.
Mm-hmm. I know exactly where you're heading.
Yeah, I would have went right there.
Yes.
Made sure my mom was safe, grabbed her, got her out of there.
Yeah, I think, you know, and again, it's hard to second guess Monday morning quarterback what people do in certain situations.
Right.
But I think I'm with you. Now, I might leave, I might, you know, call the police, but when I call my mom and she doesn't answer, then I'm in the truck and I'm headed back and whatever happens, happens. I got to check on my mom, but he decided not to do that. He decided to wait for police. The problem is police didn't get to the Hardee's until 3 a.m. This was almost 2 hours, Gibbs, after he called. And I don't think it's any rush to judgment to say that they didn't really take his call all that seriously.
Yeah, when you say there's a prowler outside, and maybe that he ran off, yeah, maybe they're not going to rush right over.
Yeah.
What else is going on?
Right. We don't know what else is going on that night, but I'm thinking 911 in a small town, how much really was probably going on? It just seems like they made it a very low priority call.
Yeah. And if you're waiting for a state trooper because you don't really have the local law enforcement, then, you know, how far are they away?
That's true.
Get there.
That's true. Probably takes a little bit longer. So State Trooper Myrna Kenny showed up and she accompanied Charles back to his trailer, right, to check things out. They did check his trailer out. It was in perfect order. There was nothing out of place, no signs of forced entry, nothing taken. And then Charles asked Officer Kenny to take a look at his mother's house just to check on her. They walked over and pretty quickly saw that one of the back windows was broken and there was blood on some of the shards of glass. Okay. Now your spidey sense is tingling, right? I think the hairs on the back of your neck are standing up at this point because I'm not feeling good.
Right. For sure. They are.
I don't know what I'm going to find when we get inside of my mom's house. So they got in, they called his mother's name, no answer. And that was strange because, you know, one of the things that Charles said was his mom, Dorothy, normally stayed up until he got home from work because she worried about him. And she said she couldn't go to sleep until he was home and she knew he was home. So he knew if his mom wasn't answering, something terrible had happened.
Yeah, there's a big problem here.
And I think a lot of parents are like that. Now, this is much later in life, right? He's 40 years old. But does it ever really leave if you're that close together? I mean, you know, I know with my kids, I can't go to sleep until I know both of them are in the house. So, I mean, I stay up pretty late anyway. But, you know, if my oldest is out till 1, I'm not going to bed at 12:30. You know, I'm waiting for her to get home. I like everybody to be in the house before I go to bed. I just feel better.
Well, that's because you hit that one little button that locks everything down.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep. Just like in, what's that movie? The Purge. I have like the Purge system.
Oh, yeah.
Just literally steel.
It is kind of like that.
Steel comes down and it's pretty secure.
It really is. I know I can't get in.
Or out sometimes.
Yeah, well, that's the other problem, yeah.
The state trooper and Charles walked upstairs, and they found his mother, Dorothy Donovan, dead, stabbed to death in her own bed. Gibbs, she'd been stabbed in the chest, arms, and face a total of 24 times.
Man, that's a lot of stab wounds.
Yeah, it really is. And it had to have been a brutal scene. You and I talk about a lot of brutal scenes. But I think as a son to walk in on your mother and see a scene like that, that's got to be, it's just heartbreaking.
Yeah.
To walk in on a loved one, any loved one that has been murdered in that way. Dorothy's time of death was estimated at around 1 a.m. on June 23rd. Like I said, Gibbs, horrific crime scene, very bloody. Blood was spattered all over Dorothy's bed and the walls of her bedroom. And I think when there are 24 stab wounds, it is going to be everywhere.
Oh, of course.
You know, sometimes in the movies, you don't see that. You don't see the spurting. But when Dexter recreates it or something like that, and you have the white sheets
right. And
the fake blood, you kind of get an idea when they try to recreate some of these crime scenes.
Well, that's
or better. When you see the photos of real crime scenes.
Right.
You know, some of these are, they're just extremely bloody because you're bound to hit an artery and then you're talking about a lot of blood spurting everywhere. And I think that one of the first thoughts that investigators had was this was overkill, you know, for some type of a random home invasion / robbery gone wrong. And you and I talk about that quite a bit, right? Overkill, rage, different things. Why do you need to stab someone 24 times?
Exactly. You know, you already killed them probably a couple stabs into it. Why do you keep going?
Yeah, at a certain number in, they're dead. But the stabbing continues. Now, a lot of times, I know you talk about the rage involved in some stabbings, and there's no doubt. So because of all of that, you know, the thought was by investigators, you know, whoever did this probably knew Dorothy, right? They were angry with her. There was a reason for the number of stab wounds, and it was because she had wronged them, or, you know, they had animosity, or they were holding animosity against her. They also thought that the perpetrator was most likely on drugs at the time, which may have influenced the violent nature of the crime. So then Charles started talking to investigators about the man, right, that he had seen walking around outside. And reportedly, Gibbs, he told them he couldn't believe the man killed his mother. So he made that connection right away.
Sure he did.
Man outside my trailer. I just got in an altercation with him previously.
Right.
He didn't find me at home. He went next door and he killed my mother. I think Charles made that connection pretty quickly. He insisted to police that the man killed his mother for revenge for what happened between the two of them. Now, You have to think about this from the standpoint of the police. Gibbs, what are they thinking when they hear this story? Strange man.
Right.
You let him out at the intersection.
How did he even know where you live?
Exactly. That's exactly what they had to have been thinking. And so to them, Charles's story didn't add up for that fact alone.
Right.
Okay. I can see you giving someone a ride. I can see you letting them out. They get angry. You get into an altercation, but you're telling me that this person that you don't know somehow magically finds your house and ends up next door and kills your mother.
Yeah.
I get it. That's kind of a hard.
It is a hard sell.
Hard sell, hard story to swallow.
Yeah.
Hard pill to swallow.
I mean, when the police are estimating her death at 1 o'clock and he's calling them at 1:19 from the Hardy's payphone, 19 minutes after the estimated time of death, that doesn't look good.
It doesn't look good from a timing standpoint because the Hardy's, I don't think, was all that far away. Right. So I'm sure police could make the inference that he could have had time. Now, he would have had to do it quickly. He could have had time to come home, kill his mother, clean himself up a little bit so he didn't have blood all over him, because obviously he didn't.
Right.
And then go to the payphone, tell the story about the man. But basically, all of it made Charles the number one suspect right from the start. Right. I think police zeroed in on him. They normally look very hard at close family anyway. We know that. You know, springtime is all about fresh air, fresh starts, and freshly cleaned homes. And it's the perfect time to give a fresh look at Simply Safe Home Security, the only home security system I use and recommend. Springtime also means more time outside and away from home. And I trust Simply Safe. I love the myriad of features that they offer. And I love the price. Simply Safe was named Best Home Security Systems for 2024 by U.S. News & World Report. The system blankets your whole home in protection. There are so many sensors, from detecting break-ins, fires, floods, and more. Plus, they have a variety of indoor and outdoor cameras to keep watch over your property day and night. It's backed by 24/7 professional monitoring for less than $1 a day. So you get fast emergency response and dispatch when you need it most. There's no contract, and they have a 60-day money-back guarantee. So you can try Simply Safe risk-free. Don't absolutely love it? Send the system back for a full refund. Simply Safe has given Gibby and I and many of our listeners real peace of mind. We want you to have it too. Get 20% off any new Simply Safe system when you sign up for Fast Protect monitoring. Just visit simplysafe.com/TCAT. That's simplysafe.com/TCATT. There's no safe like Simply Safe. True crime all the time is sponsored by BetterHelp. I want to ask everybody one question. How is your social battery right now? Does it have a ton of energy or are you drained? And why is it at that level? You know, it can be easy to ignore our social battery and spread ourselves thin. What's the right amount of socializing for you and how do you recharge? You know, maybe you're the type of person who thrives around people, or maybe you need some more alone time. Therapy can give you the self-awareness to build a social life that doesn't drain your battery. I think therapy is a very powerful tool for learning positive coping skills and helping to empower you to be the best version of yourself. If you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online, designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. No more hopping in the car, driving, and sitting in a waiting room. You can do your entire session from the comfort of your own home. All you have to do is fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist, and you can switch therapists at any time for no additional charge. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/TCAT today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/TCATT. Dorothy Donovan was murdered at the age of 70 inside the safety of her home. Her family was devastated. Dorothy was born on May 18th, 1921 in Maryland. She had three children, Charles, Brenda, and Diana. She was a widow, and she lived all alone in the farmhouse. Her first husband, Wallace Holden, died in 1958. Her second husband, Ralph Donovan, died in 1987. Dorothy was loving. She was deeply religious. She was a homemaker, a member of the Harrington Senior Center and the Church of God. She liked to keep busy with gardening, babysitting her grandkids, Bible study, and visiting the local senior center. Gibbs, this was a very sweet woman who didn't have a single enemy in the world.
You sound like the perfect grandma.
Yeah.
Yeah.
She sounds like probably most of our grandmas. But I think the key here for me is she didn't have any enemies. So, you know, who did Dorothy Donovan make so mad, so angry that they broke in and stabbed her 24 times? Well, police didn't have anyone, right? Because she wasn't that type of person. So again, it leads back to Charles as being the most likely suspect. Dorothy had gone to the hospital on June 21st for an appointment. When her daughters dropped her off, she complained that she had been hearing noises in her house. And according to the News Journal, she told her daughter, Brenda, "I'm afraid something strange is going to happen here. Something bad's going to happen to me." Okay. That's real prophetic. I mean, it turns out to be, because obviously something really bad did happen to her. Right. But I think if somebody says that to you, I mean, what do you think? Do you take it seriously? Do you blow it off?
Yeah, I think it probably just depends on the circumstance and that individual. But I think at minimum, you kind of go through the house and just check things out and be like, you know, hey, Mom, I don't see anything. Maybe it's just the wind blowing up against it. I don't know.
Yeah. I mean, there are a lot of things in houses that can make strange noises.
Sure. And
at 3 p.m. on June 22nd, Charles visited his mother before he went to work. Dorothy always packed his lunch and gave it to him before he left. That's pretty cool. It depends on how you look at it, but you're 40 years old and your mom still makes your lunch.
Still putting that little lunch pail?
Maybe a little note inside.
Yeah.
That says, hey, do great at work.
Have a good day at work, honey.
Yeah. I mean, it's really cool on her part, and sure. I'm sure it's something she wanted to do. It probably made her feel really good.
I just don't know if I'd want to keep taking that Andy Griffith lunch pail to work every day with Andy Griffith on the outside.
Yeah. Mayberry. I had the Fonz.
Did you have the Fonz?
Yeah, back in the day. And I remember, you know, almost half of those were taken up by the big soup container.
Yeah, they were.
And I never had any soup.
Yeah.
My mom wasn't big on soup, so I usually just left that at home and tried to make more room.
Everything just kind of rolled around. By the time you got it, your banana was smushed, your sandwich was smushed.
But that was kind of a status symbol when you were a kid.
Yeah.
What lunchbox did you have? And it said a lot about you.
Yeah. I just had a brown paper bag.
Right. That said a lot about you.
It did.
You had the Bionic Man lunchbox.
That's right.
And that said even more about you.
It sure did. It's like, didn't even get that at Kmart. They got it somewhere else.
They got that at J-Mart.
J-Mart. That's right.
Which is where you shopped.
Same place I got my Husky jeans.
But here's the thing. Charles could tell that something was a little bit off with his mom that day. She wasn't in the best mood. When she gave him his lunch, she didn't really even say much to him, and that wasn't like her. At 6:30 p.m., Dorothy's daughter, Diana, visited her. Dorothy complained that she didn't feel well. She thought she was getting a cold. She called Diana at 9:30 and said she was going to miss church because she didn't feel well. And that was the last time anyone heard from her.
Almost like a premonition.
It's kind of what it seems like, right? She told one of her daughters, hey, something bad is going to happen to me in my house. Mm-hmm. That is almost like a premonition.
A little scary.
As the police searched the crime scene, they found blood on the living room light switch. They also found a bloody palm print on an upstairs banister. They took swabs of the blood, put it into evidence. The way that Dorothy's body was arranged on the bed, it appeared as though she had been sexually assaulted, but the medical examiner found no evidence of that. And I think that fact made the police believe that the entire scene was staged. So when you talk about staging, well, is a random stranger really going to stage a crime scene? I think most likely not.
No.
There's really no reason for it. Would a family member stage the crime scene to make it appear as though maybe it was something different than what it was. Maybe.
Possible.
I think that's what the police thought, even, you know, kind of heaping even more suspicion onto Charles. And then on top of that, there were no items stolen from the house. So you can take out robbery as a motive. The medical examiner never determined the exact murder weapon, only that it was some type of instrument, either a screwdriver or a knife or something like that. And again, you know, Dorothy's children insisted she had no enemies. And really all of this, again, just kind of led back to Charles. No motive that they are aware of. Possible staging. He was there.
Yeah, I mean, he has to be the prime suspect at this point.
And he was. There's no doubt about it. Not just prime, but really the lone suspect. Because I don't think they believed his story about this man. So they're kind of looking at him and really only him. Police brought him in for an interview and he told the story of everything that happened that night. When he finished up, one of the investigators told him, "So you're telling us about a black male who assaulted you at the intersection and then minutes later murdered your mother. That's what you're trying to get us to believe." And basically they told him it wasn't logical. It didn't make sense. And they said they didn't even believe it was physically possible. So they didn't believe him, Gibbs, at all.
No, they felt like he was lying.
Yeah. Making all of this up. Again, I keep going back to the fugitive because it's kind of a similar story, right? The one-armed man. Well, police didn't believe there was a one-armed man.
Well, and I think they try to time it out to like, okay, this is where you say the altercation took place. If that guy that you said did this left from this location to get to your mom's house, it would take X amount of time.
Yeah, he would have had to walk about a half mile, turn down her street, their street, and, you know, putting that all together, how could a stranger do that? They just weren't buying it. So they were interrogating Charles. They kept telling him that you're lying. You're not telling the truth. But Charles didn't waver. He insisted that he was. The problem that Charles had was that the details of his story were hard to believe. You know, as we've said, as we've laid them out. One investigator told him only an idiot would believe the story you're telling us.
Well, on the surface, you can see where the police are coming from.
Yeah, because I think you and I, and probably the audience as well, if you just think about what are the odds that something like this would happen, they have to be pretty slim.
Yeah.
Not that you wouldn't pick up a hitchhiker and something goes bad, but that hitchhiker not following you home because you didn't go home.
Right.
You went a different way, ended up finding your house.
Yeah.
Looking for a place.
Right.
Magically found your house. Investigators did ask Charles to describe the hitchhiker, and they had an artist create a composite sketch. So Charles described him as a black male in his late 20s to early 30s, about 5'8", slender, said he had like a pockmarked complexion, and he was wearing oversized plastic glasses. And when he saw the drawing, he said, yeah, that's it. It's accurate, and it looks exactly like the man I saw. Now, over the next few days, police learned that Charles potentially had a financial motive to kill his mother. And we mentioned it, right? They didn't have a motive.
No.
What is the likely motive in a son or a child killing their parents?
A majority of the time, it's money.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we've seen it time and time again. There are other reasons, but I think by and large, it's financially motivated. And just before she died, Dorothy took out an accidental death life insurance policy, and she listed Charles as the beneficiary.
Well, that's not going to help his case.
No, because there's motive right there, right? In the eyes of investigators, police. And then to top it off, Gibbs, they found out that Charles was in debt. and had been for the past couple of years.
Right.
So you look at it and you say, well, this insurance money sure would have helped out. And there's no doubt it would have.
Sure. Now, Charles didn't have a criminal record.
No, he had no past, no long rap sheet, like we often talk about with many killers. But he did refuse to take a polygraph. Now, you and I would do the same thing. But detectives thought it was suspicious. Because if he had nothing to do with it, why would he refuse to take the polygraph?
Well, that's because we have seen sometimes those tests just aren't accurate and they can report things that aren't true.
Yeah. And that's why we always say, don't take one. Or, you know, at the very least, rely on your counsel, the advice of your counsel. But it's not unusual for us to be talking about cases that happened 30, 40, 50 years ago, and for the police to look at people who refuse to take a polygraph as being very suspicious, right?
Sure.
Because I think a lot of times back then they had that mentality. If you had nothing to hide, why wouldn't you take it? Because they placed a lot of belief in polygraphs, much more so than is put into them today.
Right.
And so they thought they were very accurate. And hey, if you're innocent, it will prove you're innocent. Well, we know that's not always the case, right? You get in there, you're nervous, it picks up something and it says you're being deceitful or you're lying about some question. Man, the next thing you know, you're in jail. So Charles is in the crosshairs. Police are thinking he either murdered his mother, or I think at some point, Gibbs, they started to think maybe he paid someone else to do it. Because if you factor that in, then you don't have to really worry as much about the timeline, right? Making the timeline of events fit as closely as maybe you do if he did all the stabbing himself and had to clean himself up and all of that.
So he's got a partner in crime is what they're thinking now.
Possibly. Detectives brought him back for another interview and they told Charles they had proof that he killed his mother. And Gibbs, if you see this interview, you know, at least to me, it seems as though Charles is showing genuine confusion. Like he cannot believe what these investigators are telling him.
Yeah.
That they have proof that he killed his mother.
And they're like, he's like, what proof?
Yeah.
I wasn't there. I didn't do it.
Right. Now, people put on acts. We know that. Sure. But at least to me, it seemed like it was pretty genuine. They told him they were going to charge him with first degree murder once they tested the blood. But pretty quickly, they learned that it wasn't a match, right? It wasn't his blood. And at that point, detectives were a little shocked because I think they were so confident. They knew that it was going to come back as his blood. He was the murderer. Slam dunk. We got this guy.
Yeah. I mean, on the surface, it certainly looked that way.
But they were proven wrong. And they had to accept the fact that, okay, we got to look at this. Maybe this guy did not kill his mother. And I think that's really when they started switching over completely to the, well, he must have hired someone then. And maybe it was this man that he talked about, that he had seen, that he had the fight with. Maybe that didn't happen, but he hired this man to kill his mother. Police decided to go back to try to find some witnesses to see if they could verify whether a black male was even at the restaurant that night. And they confirmed that this stranger did exist. We said that earlier. There were witnesses. They also found out that this individual had asked a number of different people for rides that night. One witness saw Charles and the man fight at the intersection. Police thought that this man was just passing through and was now long gone. He was probably most likely in a different part of the country.
Just some transient, huh?
Yeah, passing through, maybe. But what investigators did was they put together a lineup. And this was a lineup of known criminals who looked very similar to the composite sketch. And they had Charles look at these individuals, and he identified a man named Richard Mitchell from the lineup. And there were some other witnesses from the restaurant who also identified this guy, Richard Mitchell. So now police are happy again because, all right, they were wrong about Charles, maybe, but now they've got their guy. But they again turned out to be wrong. Richard Mitchell was a 33-year-old convicted criminal. He had been arrested for forgery and theft, but he wasn't a killer. He had never killed anyone. They found Richard at his home in Harrington, Delaware, and they knew right away that he wasn't the guy. He had a full beard, and the suspect was clean-shaven. Also, his palm prints didn't match the one at the crime scene, and he had a verifiable alibi. So it wasn't Richard Mitchell. Police were back at square one. At the same time, Charles was devastated because he thought for sure it was this guy. You know, he and his family were very close. They were crushed by the loss of their mother. They had no idea who had killed her. So they had to grieve her loss kind of with this hanging over their heads, right? Who did it? We don't know. We don't have any answers. The police remained suspicious of Charles. And I can see why. We said it. His story was a little strange.
Yeah, pretty complex.
It was. It was kind of complex. It was kind of far-fetched. And the crime was very personal, right? We mentioned all the factors that kind of made it look like that. They just could not accept that a complete stranger would target Dorothy after Charles had left him a pretty good distance away from her house. And Gibbs, you and I go back and forth depending on the case, right? A lot of times we support the police. Sometimes we question what they do. We kind of go where the case takes us and sure. The facts take us.
Yeah.
I kind of understand their thinking in this case.
The only conclusion I can come up with right now with the facts that have been presented is that the police are on track with their thought process.
Yeah, it seems that way. By 1994, the case was still unsolved. So police turned to unsolved mysteries as kind of a last ditch effort, right? To help generate leads, to help find some answers. One of the lead investigators told the News Journal, the case was good for TV because it's bizarre. And that's true, right? The more bizarre a case is, the more twists and turns you have, the better TV it makes.
Well, sure. And your viewership will go up.
The problem is unsolved mysteries didn't lead to any new tips and the case remained cold and a number of years passed by without any leads whatsoever. You know, my wife and I, we both use Rakuten when we shop online to help save money. My wife uses it more than I do because, well, let's face it, she shops more than I do. Rakuten is the most rewarding way to shop and save because members earn cash back on everything that they buy. Rakuten is a shopping platform that partners with over 3,500 stores across every category. You're already shopping at your favorite stores. Why not save while doing it? It really is a no-brainer. I use it for all my techie stuff at stores like Best Buy. My wife uses it at stores like Sephora and Macy. Best of all, membership is free and it's easy to sign up. It's very easy to use. Cashback rates change daily. So start all your shopping at Rakuten.com or get the Rakuten app to start saving today. Your cash back really adds up.
This episode is brought to you by June's Journey. Unleash your inner sleuth and step into the glamorous 1920s. Uncover scandalous family secrets and solve the mysterious murder of June Parker's sister. With dazzling hidden object scenes and riveting storylines in each chapter, June's Journey invites you to a thrilling era of mystery and romance. And now, June needs your help, detective. Download June's Journey for free today on iOS and Android. Your adventure awaits.
In 1999, the murder case was reopened after the FBI went over some of the evidence. Profilers took interest in it after hearing about the case from a Delaware State Police detective who was training at the FBI Academy. Records showed that at the time, a man was seen in the area who matched the description that Charles gave. The FBI profilers incorrectly determined that the killer knew Dorothy based on the remote location of her home and how the man broke in without waking her up. They also said that a stranger would not have been able to show the level of anger present at the crime scene. And again, something you and I talk about a lot. The number of stab wounds often equates to rage,
right?
At least in the eyes of police, which then in turn equates to the perpetrator knowing the victim. Because Gibbs, how do you generate that type of rage against someone that you've never met? You have nothing against. That's kind of the thinking, right? In these types of crimes, whether it's a crime of passion or revenge or whatever it is, the rage has built up to the point where I'm not just going to stab you to death. I'm going to stab you over and over and over as the rage pours out of me. I think the problem with that, and it is probably true the majority of the time, but the problem with that is you and I know we've profiled a number of killers who have selected their victims randomly, but still felt the need to stab them 30, 40, 50 times. There's rage there, I'm sure. There's also stabbing for the sake of sexual gratification. Yeah. But if it is rage, it's not directly at that person in particular. It's just built up rage that they're letting out against someone that they don't even know. And I think that's the thing with investigations, right? There is no one size fits all. There is no, well, if you have this and this and this, it must have happened this way. I just think every case is different. And that's why sometimes cases are hard to solve.
Of course, yeah.
In October of 2000, the profilers went to the home to do a walkthrough. So one agent entered through the back door that the killer used and noticed how every floorboard creaked as he walked through the house. We mentioned it. This was an old farmhouse. Dorothy always locked her doors at night. So they theorized that she must have heard this stranger, if it was a stranger, breaking into her home. Number one, the glass breaking.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah. All that glass breaking and then the creaking of the floorboards.
And then the creaking of the floorboards. We also talked about the fact that she normally tried to stay awake until her son got home. The profilers claimed that Dorothy never got out of bed because she thought the intruder wasn't a threat to her. They also claimed that if Dorothy wasn't feeling well, she might have been in a deep sleep and most likely didn't hear anything until it was too late. And this was information that they released to the public in January of 2001.
You know, I can get where she might have been in a deep sleep because we know she didn't feel well. She told her daughter that earlier that night. I do think if you heard the back door shatter, you're just not going to lay there.
Well, yeah. So the first part of that, thinking that whoever's in my house is not a threat to me, I don't understand that at all.
No.
You hear broken glass, there's a threat.
Sure.
You have to assume there's a threat. You can't just lay back down and go to sleep and say, well, yeah, somebody's breaking into my house, but they're not going to come after me.
Yeah.
That just doesn't even make sense. I'm not even sure why profilers would think that was logical. Now, if she wasn't feeling well, maybe she took some medication. That would play into it.
Right.
You know, some of those pills make you drowsy as all get out. They make you sleep great.
Might not have heard a sound.
That's true. So we mentioned that police tested the blood that they found at the crime scene. They knew it wasn't Charles. They also found out that it wasn't Dorothy's. So they assumed that it belonged to the killer. They sent it to the FBI forensic lab, who confirmed, again, it wasn't Charles. But also they confirmed that it didn't belong to any of the men in the lineup.
Okay, so it's really going to limit the pool now.
But even though police collected the DNA at the crime scene, it wasn't uploaded to CODIS until years later, it was November of 2005 that authorities finally got a DNA match. The blood belonged to 41-year-old Gilbert Cannon, a convicted felon with a long record that went all the way back, I think, to like 1981. The Delaware police had no idea Gilbert even existed until Maryland police alerted them to the DNA match. At the time, Gilbert lived in Delmar, Maryland, but in 1991, he had lived in Delaware. He had been in jail for murder in 1997. He served time for robbery and drug charges. I mentioned it, right? His record dated back to 1981 for burglary, assault, theft, resisting arrest, and two different prison escapes.
Yeah, he was a bad guy.
Yeah. He had a lot on his record. In May 2004, just before his most recent release from prison, the police collected his DNA, which allowed investigators to get their match.
So right there is where we said a little bit of luck had to come into this.
Took some time, a little bit of luck, some fortunate events. The prison staff took his DNA and blood samples because Maryland law now required DNA collection from all convicted sex offenders and felons. And to me, that's a great law. It probably took way too long to actually get that on the books in most places.
Right.
I think if you're convicted of some of these types of crimes.
Yeah, these severe levels.
Yeah, you should have your DNA taken. You should be in a database so that you can be matched to not only future crimes, but past crimes. Gilbert was released in September 2004 for good time credits. He'd served 7 years of a 12-year sentence. He was on parole and required to report to his parole supervisor. But in November 2005, he violated parole and a warrant was issued for his arrest. So we talked about it, right? Delaware police now had a match. They had a name to go with the blood that they had collected at the crime scene in 1991. The problem was they had to find Gilbert Cannon.
Yeah, this was like, where's Waldo?
Yeah. After 2.5 months, they did find him at his girlfriend's apartment in Selbyville, Maryland, just 40 miles from where he killed Dorothy Donovan. Gilbert was arrested and charged with first-degree murder on January 18th, 2006. They also added additional charges of possession of a deadly weapon during the commission of a felony and first-degree burglary. After his arrest, they took his palm print, and they were able to match it to the bloody palm print left at the crime scene.
Finally.
Yeah. So there's no doubt, right? You got the DNA match. You got the palm print match. He was in the house.
Matches his MO.
Yeah, it did. I mean, he broke into houses. We know he committed at least one other murder because he was in jail in 1997. I don't know the exact circumstances of that murder. But a 12-year sentence doesn't sound like much, and you're out in 7 after committing murder?
Seems a little light.
It does. Again, I don't know what the circumstances were. I don't know what the degree ended up being, and that plays a big factor. Charles was officially cleared as a suspect. And I don't know, Gibbs, we haven't talked about it yet, but this had to have been huge for him. Because if you think about it, 14 years, this cloud of suspicion kind of hung over his head, right? Police suspected him of murder. And, you know, it took them 14 years to fully believe his story. And I think the other problem that Charles had was with his family, right? He had siblings. I don't know how suspicious they were of him that he actually killed their mother. I don't know that they believed that. I think what caused a big rift in the family was that they believed whoever he gave the ride to killed their mother.
Yeah.
If they believed his story. Well, now they knew it was true at a certain point, and they were very upset about that. You know, he didn't kill their mother.
But this person he gave a ride to
did.
And what's his involvement in that in the end?
Yeah, I think they wondered why he would even give this guy a ride. And I don't think the siblings and Charles spoke for many, many years. I think they finally mended the rift after, you know, this Gilbert Cannon guy was identified. But, you know, this, there's no doubt that, that Charles went through a lot.
Yeah. I don't know if you could ever explain why you did what you did. That's going to make everybody happy. Like, why did you just take this guy to the hospital?
Right.
You know, why did you decide to take him and then stop just minutes later at the intersection that you would typically turn to go to mom's house? Why there? Why'd you stop there?
Sure. Yeah. I get it, right? You can second guess a lot of things. And I'm sure he himself had a tremendous amount of guilt on top of having to live with all this suspicion that everybody was kind of heaping on him.
Oh, yeah.
The police, his family, they were all kind of looking at him for many, many years.
Well, I'm sure he found out who his true friends were through those years.
Yeah, I'm sure he did. I hope he had some. Because his family didn't speak to him for quite a long time. Now, when police first interviewed Gilbert, he denied everything. He said, you know, I'm not going to sit here and say I killed somebody. I'm not even going to say I was there. And even when they confronted him with all of the evidence, the DNA, the palm print, he still denied it. But a few hours later, Gilbert knocked on his holding cell window and he told the police that he wanted to talk, and he kind of spilled it. He said, basically, I went out. He said, I don't know if it was the drugs or whatever. He said, I don't really have any reason to lie about it now. And he told them everything. He said that he was high on cocaine. He blamed that for his behavior that night. And he said that after Charles sped off, he just kind of wandered down the road looking for somewhere to sleep. And he said he was passing houses, and these houses all had their lights on. And he was looking for some place that was abandoned where he could just lay down and sleep. He knocked on one door, no one answered. And really, Gibbs, the first house he found with no lights on belonged to Dorothy Donovan. And he decided to break in through the back door. And he told investigators that the noise of the window breaking woke Dorothy up. And that's why he killed her, so that she could not identify him. He stabbed her to death while she was laying in her bed. And he used the screwdriver that he stole from Charles's truck.
Yeah, the one he went after Charles with.
Yep. But I think Gilbert was genuinely surprised when police told him that the woman he had killed was Charles's mother. He had no idea.
Just a coincidence.
And that's what he told him. He said it was a coincidence that he targeted Dorothy. He had no idea that she was Charles's mother. Dorothy's daughters were relieved to find this out. And I think this is when the healing of the rift began.
Yeah, I think Charles needed that information to come out.
When his sisters did too.
Sure, yeah.
Because that's when I think they finally accepted that Charles really had no connection to the murder, right? And it wasn't his actions even that led to this guy killing their mother. It really was a coincidence.
Yeah, there really was no connection between the altercation with Charles and the murder of Dorothy.
On April 24th, 2007, Gilbert Cannon pled guilty to first-degree murder, and he was sentenced to life in prison without the possibility of parole. The only other option available for a first-degree murder conviction in Delaware besides capital punishment. Now, the state was planning to pursue the death penalty, but his guilty plea took that off the table. So, obviously, that's why he pled guilty.
Yeah. Well, look, he's in prison for the rest of his life, so I'm good with that.
I'm good with that too. I'm still trying to figure out how he got out 7 years for the other murder.
Yeah. Yeah.
I would love to know more about that, but I just couldn't find it.
Get a little more deets around that.
Yeah. Charles's sister Brenda told the News Journal that she would have preferred the death penalty, but Diana was happy with the plea bargain. Charles gave no comment to media outlets after the sentencing. All of Dorothy's children were glad the case was finally closed and that they got justice for their mother.
Well, I bet. Finally. After all those years.
It took a while. Now, I do find it interesting that you have one sister who really wanted to see this man put to death. The other sister was happy with the life in prison. And I understand how that happens.
Yeah.
Because I get it. Some people want to see the person that killed their family member pay the ultimate price. But then I think there are some Gibbs who, you know, really look at what's involved in a death penalty case.
Right.
And they think, I don't want to go through all that.
Yeah.
Because you have all the appeals. You have all of these things coming up. There's going to be news reporting on this guy. Some people just want him to go away.
Yeah. Disappear in the background.
Into a cell, never to be heard from again. Right. And I understand both of the arguments. I really do. Much more so than when you and I first started this podcast.
Oh, yeah. I think our views have changed over time.
They have, with knowledge, sure, right?
Exactly.
Knowledge about how the system works and how it affects the victim's family members.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because we've heard that time and time again, even from people that have written into us.
Right.
You know, that's hard.
It is.
On them. It's like reliving the event every time that this person comes up for some type of appeal or there's a hearing or just whatever it is. I think one of the really sad parts of this, I mean, outside of Dorothy's murder, because obviously that was tragic, but it's how it tore the family apart. And I mentioned it. They didn't talk for a long time. They tried to mend it. They still don't talk all that often.
Yeah, I think when you have that 14-year gap of not really communicating and blaming somebody for something that they had nothing to do.
But you thought they did.
But you thought they did. I think it's kind of hard to overcome that.
Yeah. Yeah, I think it's tough if you really thought in your heart that your brother or sister was the reason for your mother's murder.
Yeah.
And I think that's what his sisters thought.
Well, for at least 14 years they did.
Yeah. Not that he necessarily killed her.
Yeah.
Although they might have been suspicious at one time.
I think they probably were at one point.
But then even later thinking, okay, your actions and what you did that night kind of led up to her being murdered.
Yeah. If you didn't pick him up, drive him to that intersection, maybe he wouldn't have walked that way. Maybe he wouldn't have had your screwdriver in his hand. You can always do the Monday morning quarterback thing on this one and come up with several different scenarios of what he should or shouldn't have done.
In 1994, Charles told Unsolved Mysteries, "The whole story seemed like a big nightmare to me. It's like you're in some kind of a dream. You don't think it really happened. You think you could drive over to my mother's house and she could be there. But I know that's not going to really happen." Dorothy used to call her daughters every morning and every night to tell them good morning and good night. And what they miss most, Gibbs, is her friendship. Diana told the producers of Unsolved Mysteries, if she had been killed in an automobile accident or had a medical problem, all right, I could have accepted that. And I don't think anybody has a right to kill someone to take away their life like that. Well, I think we all agree with that.
Oh, for sure, yeah.
And obviously it is much tougher, not that losing a parent's not tough, but you know, losing someone to a vicious murder,
right,
as opposed to, you know, an illness or something like that, it's got to be a little different.
Oh, I mean, how vulnerable she had to be at that moment, the pain she had to go through. Nobody wants to think how their mom suffered.
So Gibbs, as we wrap up this case, you know, again, we have another case solved by advancements in DNA. We're seeing that all the time, right? We can get justice for victims, bring closure to families in cases that maybe we never thought we could. We thought they were so cold.
Yeah.
No suspects. But DNA will get you. Can get you.
It's here for the long haul.
To me, I think this story also serves as a warning to be wary of strangers. I mean, we're taught that from an early age, right? Don't talk to strangers. Don't get into cars with strangers.
Stranger danger.
Now, do we lose some of that as adults? I think many of us do.
Yeah.
And I'm not saying Charles shouldn't have done what he did. I can't say that because I think everybody has to make that decision for themselves. I think he thought he was doing something kind for a stranger. It turned out very, very bad.
Really bad. And I think he had some type of instinct after he pulled away. And that's why he wanted the guy to get out of his car and said, I can't go any further.
I think you're right.
You know?
I think you're right. But I don't know. I'm just in the camp of why even put yourself in that position.
So here, buddy, call Uber today.
Today. There's no doubt. Charles deeply regrets his decision to show kindness to a stranger. And that's sad. It really is. And I know people will think bad of me for saying what I do about the fact that, no, I wouldn't do it because...
Well, I don't think they're going to think bad of you.
Well, some people might. Some people think, you know, you're supposed to help people, and yeah. You are.
I think what they would think bad is when you see somebody out on the side of the street needing help, and you know that you can't take them, but you still swerve near them and splash the water up on them.
Yes.
That's not nice.
That is not nice.
And you do that. But, you know, outside of that.
I've done that to you multiple times.
You have.
But, you know, it is such a strange story. You know, when you think about it, his story was so unbelievable.
Oh, yeah.
To the police, I think even to some of his family members, to people in town for, what, 14 years?
Yeah.
Until it was finally proven that he wasn't involved in his mother's murder in any way. And that really, the entire thing was just a series of tragic coincidences.
Yeah. But he's lucky that they did take blood samples that day.
Yeah.
And eventually that they were actually able to identify Gilbert because they got his blood before he left the prison in 2004.
Right. So all it's like dominoes, right? All these things had to fall into place for Charles to get the outcome or for everybody to find out really that he had nothing to do with it.
Right.
But, you know, I'm sure he carries around a lot of guilt.
Oh, I would think so, yeah.
You know, thinking about, okay, what would have happened if I had not given Gilbert Cannon a ride that night? Could he have possibly still stumbled onto my mother's house? Would he have broken into someone else's house and killed another person?
Right.
My assumption is he also probably thinks about if he had been there, could he have done something to protect his mother? If he had not taken the drive, if he had gone
straight home,
or if he'd have gone back to the house as soon as he saw the guy, if he'd have confronted him instead of driving away to the Hardee's to call police. But again, you really can't say that he did the wrong thing. It's really kind of hard to say that.
It is. I mean, you can second guess it, but.
No, I think he probably does.
Oh, I'm sure he does.
Yeah. And then I think you have to ask the question. Would things have been different if police had taken his call more seriously, if someone had shown up much quicker, then they would have gotten to the house much quicker? I don't know. Would they have caught him or discovered him while he was still there and maybe not prevented the murder, but it wouldn't have taken 14 years to solve it.
Right.
So,
yeah.
But that's it for our case on Gilbert Cannon. I just found it fascinating because of all the different pieces to the puzzle.
Oh, yeah.
And you had to have each one fall into place for it all to play out the way it did. We got some voicemails, Gibbs. You want to check those out?
Let's hear them.
Hi, Mike and Gibby. I just want to say I enjoy your podcast so much. I normally listen to them when I walk, and I used to walk about 3 miles a day, and I accidentally walked 8 the other day because I couldn't stop listening. Thank you for what you do. It's really, really interesting, and I'm calling from Alabama. All right, take care, and keep doing what you're doing.
All right, love Alabama.
We do.
So either Roll Tide or War Eagle, depending on who you root for.
Just depends.
Yeah.
Okay.
because it's usually one of those two.
Yeah.
She likes the podcast. That's awesome. We also got her to walk more than what she normally would have.
Yeah. See, we made you step it up.
We're fitness motivators.
We are.
And we didn't even know it.
Hey, Mike and Gibby, this is Orlando calling from Salt Lake City, Utah, and I'm on my way to work right now. I just heard your newest episode you put out, and I had a couple things to say. First of all, Slayer is not a death metal band. It's a thrash metal band. It's actually one of the really big four bands that pioneered thrash metal, really. And that's what a lot of people don't get. They think, oh, death metal band, thrash metal bands evil and satanic. No, we just like to express ourselves in different ways, and it's music. That's all, really all it is. Thanks for letting me talk. I hope you guys get put this on one of your shows, but I'll be listening, and thank you for what you guys do. I appreciate everything. All right, bye.
All right, thanks to Orlando. I actually did get Gibbs a lot of emails and a lot of voicemails about Slayer.
Right.
And he's absolutely correct. I looked it up. They're really considered more of a thrash metal, whatever that is. Again, I don't listen to any of that. But I will tell you this, all of the reporting said death metal. And,
right.
And maybe that was being sensational,
sure.
Right? Because yeah. of what these kids did. Now, I never blamed any of it on Slayer.
No.
Now, do I like some of their lyrics? No. But, you know, in my teens, I used to listen to some rap that I wouldn't listen to today because, you know.
Yeah.
It didn't make me want to go out and shoot the police, though.
No.
And I do think, you know, blaming everything, all bad things on music, video games, it just can't be.
No.
There's no way. It's too easy to say that this causes all of this, and it doesn't. There's so many people that listen to that music, so many people that play the video games. They never hurt anybody. They never want to hurt anybody.
Just got to take responsibility for your own actions, people.
Yeah.
Hey, Mike and Gibby. This is Tim from down here in Southwest Georgia. I just wanted to take a moment and let y'all know just how much I enjoy your podcast. I've been listening to y'all for a little over a year now, and I caught completely up on episodes and had to take a brief break for you to come out with some new episodes. Just wanted to take a moment and let y'all know to keep doing what you're doing. I completely enjoy y'all. You both crack me up and do one heck of a job presenting the information in the best way possible. So y'all boys keep at it and keep you on time ticking. We enjoy you down here in Southwest Georgia. Thank you.
First of all, one of my favorite accents of all time.
Yeah, I knew
love
you were
that accent. You know, I love a Southern accent.
Yeah,
absolutely. But I also appreciate the kudos. You and I appreciate those type of compliments very much.
Sure, we do.
You know, we do put a lot of work into the show, and we appreciate it when people like it.
Yeah, it's nice.
Makes us feel good.
Well, it does make you feel good.
Might have to head down to Southwest Georgia.
On your way down to Alabama?
No, we'll just do Southwest Georgia and just have everybody come,
you know,
from Alabama and
right there,
all the surrounding states.
Right there in the little tri-county area or tri-state or whatever that is.
Tri-county. Oh, you are something else.
Hey, Mike and Gibby, what's happening? My name is Sana. I am calling from Everett, Washington. And I had to laugh because I was just listening to the Richard Lyons episode, and you were talking about Scantrons, and I wanted to let you know, just recently, I was the office manager of a high school. Now I work at the district office, but we still use Scantrons. It's so ridiculous how expensive they are, and it's ridiculous that we still use them, but I just had to let you guys know because that was super funny. I am neither Gibby or Mike team. I love you guys both. Keep your own time ticking.
Got your number two pencil, people. Number two pencil.
Number two pencil. Because for some reason, it only works with the number two pencil.
That's right.
Now, I'm kind of surprised to hear that Scantrons are still in use because, you know, I've seen my daughters, you know, as they went through high school. And it's just like, man, everything is so digital.
Yeah.
And or if that's even the right word. They're on, you know, cloud-based, Google. I mean, I don't even see them writing things. It's not like they're, you know, they're typing.
Yeah.
All the time and sending their work.
Electronically?
Electronically, thank you. Because yeah. I was getting ready to say through the interwebs. through the interwebs.
Interwebs.
All right. We got some mailbag.
Yeah.
And all of this was from CrimeCon. So our good friend Mary Beth Long brought us some t-shirts.
Awesome.
We love her. Our good friend Sue Kelly brought some Buc-ee's peanuts and candy corn. Yeah. First of all, we love Buc-ee's.
We do.
It's our favorite convenience store.
It is.
Even though we don't have them here.
No, but we like them when we go there.
Yep. When we travel to Texas. I don't know where else Buc-ee's is. I've really only been to them in Texas, I think.
Yeah.
But she brought that specifically to simulate Gibby's grandma's potato candy.
Yeah.
That you talked about in at least one episode. Said you were going to make me some. Didn't.
Nope.
Have not. That was a year or two ago. Oh, no. Probably 2 years. We did a taste test on our weekly Patreon video, and you said it was surprisingly close.
It was. I was really surprised. You got to do the right ratio.
Yeah, we weren't sure what the ratio of peanuts to candy corn was, but and then there was a couple at CrimeCon that gave us some very cool t-shirts. Yeah. I got Dahmer. You got Gacy. It was based on who we wouldn't want to eat dinner with, if you remember that conversation.
Yeah, yeah.
They also gave my daughter's Dunkin' Donuts gift card. So it just shows you how closely they're paying attention to the podcast. The problem is I didn't get their name.
Oh.
So please send me an email.
Yes.
Tell me who you are so I can give you a proper credit.
And we'll know if it's not really you.
Yeah. But that's it, Gibbs. That's it for another episode of True Crime All the Time. So for Mike
and Gibby.
Stay safe and keep your own time ticking. I want to tell everybody about a game that I've been playing recently called Two Dots. You know, primarily Two Dots is a puzzle-based game. You have to connect at least two dots of the same color to make a move. And then those connected dots are removed from the game area and the dots above them drop down until they hit other dots or the floor beneath. But there's a variety of game modes. There's this really cool one called Scavenger Hunt, which is a really relaxing hidden object game. There's different levels to the game that are grouped into worlds, and it's very satisfying to move up. There's over 5,000 unique puzzles and fun levels, and with all the different gameplay modes, it really makes the gaming experience unique and exciting with every single puzzle. The visuals are amazing, and the in-game music I found to be very soothing. You can even challenge your friends on Facebook to make it competitive, link up, and see how your dot skills match up. And best of all, it's free to download, and you don't need Wi-Fi to play it. You can play it offline as well. Think you have what it takes to solve some fun puzzles? Download Two Dots now for free on Android or iOS.